And
a fruit bowl, a fruit bowl, and a croissant would be great. That's all.
All grey tea, croissant, and a fruit bowl.
That would be perfect.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, my favorite still from United 93 is the one that was taken, at the end of the shooting. With everybody in a big group. That was one of the most delightful photos.
Yes.
I just thought it was just nice.
I remember that photo being taken. And of course we've got the sky behind us.
Right.
Because we were in the studio, there's a, you know, because we were shooting out of the plane, they had the sky put out just in case, that, you know. Mm-hmm.
I never interviewed you, of course, for the 93, but I was always wondering if your, the thing that I considered a real dimensional victory as far as your character was concerned was your saying, I love you, to someone.
Yeah.
So was that always written in? Is that something you came up with? Was that
No. I mean, that was something that we knew that he did. Hmm. He called it was his girlfriend in Germany. I mean, yeah, because he was... I mean, it's something that's in the film just by virtue of the fact that we knew it. Not just that bit, but, I mean, because he, out of the whole 19 hijackers, was the odd one out. Like, he had a secular upbringing, he went to a Christian school,
right.
He had a girlfriend in Germany, as you said. He tried to pull out the whole operation of July in 2001. And also, like, on September the 9th, he'd called his family to say that he'd see them on the 22nd. And then also there's all the stuff that we know, and then crucially the hijacking itself took place on all the other planes 5 minutes after the seatbelt sign went off, and on this plane there was a 26 minute delay between seatbelt sign and hijacking, which if you think of it from their perspective is entirely catastrophic because they're flying in the wrong direction, so that actually means 52 minutes to your back where you were supposed to be.
Right.
And
I never.
And so the presumption, everyone kind of asked the question, why that delay?
Right.
And with that background and that history and all that, the presumption, him being the leader of them on that plane,
that he was
the reason, for whatever reason, whether it was doubts, conscience, fear, whatever it might be. That's why that particular story is told in that way, if you like, in the film.
It's very clear that there's some kind of. Something's conflicting.
Yeah.
Quite clearly. That's another thing that I thought was really good in thinking about it. You know, because I hate black and white.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think the whole film is really about, it's about humanizing the event. It's humanizing heroism and it's humanizing, you know,
now, bending acts. All the way around, bending backwards, in that I believe that it... interesting drama will allow for the worst monsters to have some kind of human
Absolutely.
Joseph Goebbels looked in the mirror every morning, said, I'm not that bad.
Absolutely.
I've got my reasons.
And he's much
I love
more,
my children.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he's much more terrifying when he's that kind of person, when he is just as a simple monster. It's like, for me, it's just like, you know, the idea of a human being committing something monstrous. Makes for much more challenging and much more terrifying, I think, questions than if it's a monster who commits something monstrous, because then all you have is, like, why did they do it? Because they're a monster, and it's not.
Right.
It's too simple.
So, if one were to look at the Kite Runner from the perspective of a ardent, committed Taliban person, one might feel this is not fair. We are about the spirit. We are about restoring that which is good in our culture. We're not these, you know, I mean, they would be in denial or they would argue strenuously, which is one reason, or perhaps the primary reason, why those stories have come out about your co-stars in The Kite Runner are probably going to, at least temporarily, if not permanently, relocate. Which is why the film has been...
Basically it's been delayed because... It's a mixed bag, I think, but the reason it's been delayed is because of fears that there could be adverse reactions in Afghanistan. So if there are any, we need to know that they're going to be safe. As simple as that. So that's why they're going to be relocated. And then if there are adverse reactions, then they're safe, and if there aren't, the precaution's been taken, basically.
Now, rather than me run down the basics, I just wanted, could you please, just for the sake of the interview, explain the two social classes in Afghanistan as they were in the late 70s, and how that, I believe that the Taliban is in some way closer to or affiliated with the, you know, the upper class. Is that,
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, Afghanistan's always a difficult one to talk about as a country, because it has about, I think, 19 different ethnicities.
Really?
Many of whom have kind of cross-border allegiances and different relationships with each other, which have developed even more since the 1970s on account of the civil war that they had in the 90s. For the purposes of the film, the main groups that is the film really talks about is the Hazara and the Pashto. And the Pashto are the most populous ethnicity. They're not the majority. And they're predominantly in the south, but also, you know, very strongly present in Kabul. And as a result of being the most populous, them, along with the Tajiks, and it gets very complicated, but them along with the Tajiks have been traditionally the most, the closest to authority. And interestingly, although it's not directly referenced in the film, in the book it is, Amir is also a Pashto.
Okay.
It's actually, you get a kind of lateral reference to it in the point where, you know, Asif shouts at Amir for associating with a Hazara, saying, if it weren't for idiots like you and your father, i.e. you're part of us. The Hazara are are pretty much the second-class citizens of Afghanistan. The majority of Afghanistan is Sunni. The Hazara are Shia. They look different because their descendants, well, one of the theories is that they're descendants from the Mongols who came through Afghanistan. They're very often the serving class. And
this
so,
is, of course, the young boy.
This is the young boy Hassan.
And so, abused and raped and later.
Exactly, and also abused and raped, and also he has a father who he doesn't know is his father. And so, part of the issue in between those two is that it would be—it's very strange socially. You know, just as it would be, for example, in South Africa. You know, during and before apartheid, to have a best friend who you were seen all the time with, who was black. So that's the peculiarity of that relationship. In its kind of ethnic background. I mean, in relation to that scene, I think it develops in different issues, and then in relation to the controversy that surrounds that scene, I think it is also on a different level. Because part of the controversy, I think, about the scene, because I think for anyone who sees the film, whether they're Pashto or Hazara or whatever it might be, or Afghan of whatever ethnicity, it's very clear that the spirit of the film, the story of the film, is as pro-humanity, as pro-Afghanistan in all its various ethnic divides, if you like, as can be, I think.
Well, it seems very pro what is beautiful and eternal about Afghan culture.
Absolutely. So in a way, for me, part of the controversy builds out of people not having seen the film, and the talk about the film being about a rape scene, and it being a Hollywood film.
Oh, also the way the Taliban is portrayed, once you go back and
it doesn't come so much out of that. It's okay. Most of what's come is related to the rape scene, particularly.
Okay.
And actually, it's been more out of a fear that somehow it would be deemed not respectable to have a Hazara being abused by a Pashto.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually mainly come from the Hazara side rather than the Pashto side, interestingly.
Interestingly enough. Oh, okay. Because it feels humiliating to them as a
potentially, but it's also out of not knowing the story, and if you like, because of the, I mean, something that makes me so proud to be part of this film is that it's one of the first films that I can think of where the first point of contact with that part of the world is a human family story and not political violence.
You know, it's funny, when I think anybody that knows a little bit about the world knows that rape is a dominance, about control, power, it's about showing contempt. Right? And pretty much universally understood that if it's a man-on-man rape of another guy, he's basically saying, I spit on you, you are mine, you are nothing, I am, you know. Any culture.
Absolutely.
Same message.
Absolutely.
But people that are, they do not see that as a universal thing, they see it as a more particular culture.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think there's a slight confusion between what it would be in the worst possible scenario, which is what everyone will imagine. If all they hear is Hollywood film, rape scene, Hollywood film, rape scene, Hollywood film, rape scene in Afghanistan, because, of course, you know, Afghans don't feel generally very well represented by Hollywood. And actually seeing the film, and there's been a whole load of Afghan people who've seen the film, Hazara or non-Hazara, here and elsewhere, who have responded so positively to the film. And there's actually a huge dialogue that's been going on Afghan television and elsewhere about this, and the number of people who rally in support is huge. But the main issue, as I see it, tends to be whether or not you've seen the film or read the book, and of course a lot of people haven't.
The huge dialogue that you speak of, this has been happening in Afghanistan primarily since the big stories start to come out about how there's concern.
I think it's been there in the background in relation to the book in a certain extent, but it's grown with the film. But as I say, I think the focus is more on a mythology that's being built and that's being dealt with now, and is gradually disseminating in a more open way. But I mean, certainly, if you know nothing about the film or the book, which a lot of people don't, and then you hear rape scene and you hear Hollywood film, the combination that you're going to build in your head is negative. And I think that's part of what the film is contending with.
I would love to see you play a London stockbroker in a...
So would I.
You know,
it'll happen.
In a film like Closer or something.
Absolutely.
It had nothing to do with FSC or...
Yeah. Absolutely. That's why.
Because I think it's obviously you're excellent in both these films.
Thank you.
And it's a very moving performance, particularly in The Kite Runner. But I'm just aware of the pigeonholing that
Absolutely.
With us, you know.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, but also I kind of consider myself lucky in the two films that I've done to have been part of breaking trends. And you know, it's from the first, you know, the first step has been a film very much pitted against stereotypes, especially in terms of the on all sides really. And then this is a film which, as I said, is the first Hollywood film where the concentration is on the people who've been brutalized as opposed to the people brutalizing in that part of the region. You know, Afghanistan's a country that at one point had over 6 million refugees. It lost about 2 million people in the war with Russia, and the fact that when you think of the stories that come with that trauma, and the fact that all that's associated with being Afghan, or indeed being Arab or Muslim, are negative associations before they're anything else. They're Taliban, they're beards, they're bombs, before it's anything positive, is a big tragedy to me. And this is kind of a film which, in its thrust, for me is about redressing a balance, which is, you know, which has a long... Thank you very much. And so, you know, this one, you know, I play an American Afghan, which kind of in representation terms, in film or otherwise, is almost kind of treated as if it's, thank
you. Croissant is right in the bottom, and your toast is
okay. Perfect.
You want to put some coffee for you, sir?
Thank you.
All right. Is anything else I can do for you?
Nope, it's great, thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
you know, as if it's kind of anathema to be Afghan and American, and, you know, like that representation hasn't been there before. And so, yeah, I'm kind of hoping that the next step for me is something which is not about my ethnicity, which is about how I live, you know, like, you know, the cities I love, like London, like LA, like New York, like Cairo, they're cosmopolitan cities where I can walk down the street and it's about who I am when I speak, not what I look like.
The thing that is so moving, I think, that I can feel the emotional reaction to the film when I saw it. Thank you. Let me put it over here. I can get out of your way.
I'm fine, but yeah, it's like serious.
Is that the fundamental thing is that it's about there isn't anybody that doesn't have some sin or thoughtless thing that they done when they were younger. Maybe they're teens, but everybody's got something
absolutely
they feel badly about. And those things stay with you. And I speak from absolute experience because of when I was a kid, I was scared. We had been talking in elementary school about snapping turtles.
Right.
And I was very afraid of meeting a snapping turtle who could bite my finger off. I found a turtle in this, and I got scared, and I thought it might be a snapping turtle, and I hit the turtle with a piece of wood over and over and over again, stupidly, and the poor turtle the shell started to bleed, and I can't get that image out of my head all my life.
Yeah.
I can't. It's upsetting.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think every, you know, it's a very common thing.
No, absolutely.
That's why everybody gets so moved by the film.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's I mean, I think the other thing that's so moving about the film as well is it's the way in which it's a story about growing up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about the moment that everybody really wants, in relation to their parents or their father. In the case of this, where you stand up and you feel like your father is proud of you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's in a way something that Amir searches for his whole life, and he doesn't know why his. First of all, he doesn't know why his father has a troubled relationship with him, and realizes that there's something about his father's relationship with him which makes his father feel bad, and he doesn't understand that until later. And then there's the point at which he feels like his father never feels proud of him, and the whole story. It's only really at the end of the film, it feels to me, where he's finally kind of become a man. You know, it's the difference between being an adult and being leaving your childhood behind, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very moving as well. Wanting your father to say, "I'm proud of you."
Have you had any thing offered to you since? Since 1993, or since this film started to be screened, about that is not about a character of any kind of Middle Eastern ancestry.
There've been a few things that have come my way.
Mm-hmm.
There's been more of the other stuff that's come my way, but nothing so far in terms of what has been the right kind of role for me or. But that's certainly one of the things I'm looking for. I mean, I really hope it happens. But I mean, part of it as well has been waiting for this film to come out, because then, you know, I'm hopefully in a different position. Although the funny thing for me is, you know, is that so far I've not I guess people don't really know where I'm from.
You don't know you're British, you mean?
Well, I mean, in sort of a general sense, I mean, my obviously friends and people who I meet do, but for people who don't, the presumption after the 1993 is that I'm Arabic and that probably I live somewhere in the Middle East.
Okay.
The presumption after this might be that I'm Afghan or American.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I've got like a very... I'm born in Scotland, I'm brought up in London, my parents are Egyptian, and my father is born in Illinois. So it's kind of... it's And...
Just going off the track button for a second, did anybody that you know well in Afghanistan, I presume you know people?
Now, yes.
Just anybody in the region, that's in the general region, saw Michael Winterbottom's films.
In this world?
About the three Afghanistan.
In this world? The one where he follows them from Afghanistan to London. That one?
Actually, no. The Road to Guantanamo.
Oh, The Road to Guantanamo. Yeah.
I always thought that was one of the stupidest things that a person from that region would do, which is to go back there for a wedding right in the wake of 9/11 and, you know, not have your papers, you know, just anything that would cause suspicion.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Wolf Blitzer on CNN saying over and over again that there's stuff coming down, you know. I just didn't understand why people thought that film was, you know. I thought it was, I mean, obviously it's appalling with people being tortured in Guantanamo, but it was just constantly stupid.
I think part of it in relation to that film was, I mean, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and it's kind of a slightly unanswered question, I think, in the film.
Mm.
And I mean, part of it was as well, he just, you know, telling a story about some British Pakistani Muslims. But yeah, I mean,
apart from my viewpoint, I want to validate my viewpoint. Did anybody have any reaction that you've ever seen to from the region, who has ever seen the film?
Not from Afghanistan that I've talked to. I haven't spoken to anyone in Afghanistan about it. I don't think it's a widely seen film in Afghanistan, not least because it's in English. But certainly people I know who come from the Middle East who've seen the film, I mean, that question is definitely there. Like, you can't, whether their intentions were entirely innocent or not, you can't get away from the thing of, hang on, You went in just as for sightseeing or for you know, I mean, there's a but, you know, you have to presume innocence until proven guilty, and it does seem that they were not, you know, that they weren't going there to do anything nefarious.
From what you've was there any awareness or interest in when you were over there and talking about Charlie Wilson's War, which is about the
In Afghanistan, though, I mean, I was there. I mean, no, because it wasn't. I guess it wasn't so. I mean, it wasn't so current then, and I guess in many ways, kind of Charlie Wilson's War is more about here than it is about Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
But
did it not? From what I read, the supplying of these missiles to surreptitious means.
The supplying of arms to Afghanistan, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of extends, I think, beyond. I mean, because, yeah, I mean, Afghanistan, there's a beautiful report that I've got, which was written by Amnesty in 1996, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
which is just in the wake of the beginning of the civil war in Afghanistan, or maybe it was a bit less than that, which is essentially about the irresponsibility of so many different parts of the world, including the US, but the US, the Saudis, the British, I think, to some extent, Pakistan, Egypt as well, the Iranians, the Russians, of course, just stockpiling weapons and not caring really who gets, you know, not caring what they're used for. And the main thrust of that Amnesty piece was, you know, every nation that supplies arms has a responsibility to ensure that they are not used to kill innocent civilians. And of course, they were. And of course, the worst thing that happened to Afghanistan, which is also, to go back to that rape scene, really what it's about as well. And this is something that Khalid Hosseini pointed out to me, which I think is beautiful. I mean, he said, like, that rape scene for him, as well as having its place in the story on its own terms, it's also about standing by and watching as someone who you love, or someone who has something special, is being raped, and you can't do anything about it, or you don't do anything about it. And that, for him, is very much the situation that a lot of Afghans felt themselves in, leaving the country and standing by while it's raped and not being able to do anything. Likewise, it's a relationship that the international community has had with Afghanistan, standing by and watch it being raped while it does essentially nothing. And you know, the main period of greatest neglect was straight after the Russians left, which is when the country fell into civil war, and which is where, I mean, a vast, vast amount of destruction that followed, you know, happened. And you had just warlord after different small group after big group with a huge amount of weapons fighting for control.
Right.
And weapons still coming into the country and people dying left, right and centre.
The prolonged...
Until, of course, you know, until after September the 11th.
Yeah. It just seems that every region, every nation, every culture goes through its period of tumult and upheaval. You know, in this country went through a terrible thing in the Civil War. Had a lot of very difficult episodes. Obviously, the 60s here was very rough times. But God, it just seems like the whole Middle Eastern area, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, it's just much more than their share. And it just seems like it doesn't end. It just doesn't stop. There's no end to the death, to the hate, to the you know, it's just every evil thing you can think of.
I mean, it's a very troubled region for a whole host of reasons. I mean,
when Japan, you know, got upset by American economic policies, attacked Pearl Harbor, atomic bomb. That was like 6-7 year period. And then they started to rebuild, then they moved on, and it's been...
But with the Middle East, this is the kind of melting pot. You've got the immediate aftermath of coming out of being... you've got immediate aftermath of being post-colonial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like most of them were left in the 40s or 50s. On top of that, you've got the fact that in 1917... the British and French essentially carved up that part of the world along lines that it had not lived in. Borders that were created in the sand for geopolitical reasons regarding the British and French rather than the locality.
We're talking about the World War One era.
We're talking about 1917, about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. That created Lebanon and Syria and Iraq, all these places that we hear about having problems.
First time I heard of the Sykes-Picot Treaty, not being very attentive in history class at that time, it was Lawrence of Arabia. They mentioned at the very end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's always stuck with me.
And then on top of that, you've also got, you know, on top of that, you've got the whole, you know, that's exactly as well the point at which the whole Arab-Israeli problem, you know, comes in with the creation of Israel in the region. So, with that whole melting pot, and then shortly afterwards the discovery of oil, and then partisan interests coming from outside, which are interested in not the region but the money that can come out from the oil wells.
Mm-hmm.
It you've got all these destabilizing forces.
Yep.
And then on top of that, you have the Cold War. And one of the Middle East is a huge casualty of the Cold War, I think. I mean, principally because it's again about creating balances of power that are not native to the country. So as soon as that collapses, so for example, with the case of Iran, you see it in Egypt now, you see it all over the Middle East. There was a very strong progressive leftist movement fighting for social reforms and fighting for democracy and all those kind of things, but because they were on the left, they were fought against very strongly during the Cold War. And the main tool used by most of the governments in power, most of whom were allied with the US, the main tool used to fight was the religious right.
Right.
And so the religious right pretty much destroyed the left and destroyed everything in the middle as well.
Yeah.
So what you ended up with is basically, you have a power vacuum essentially, and at one pole you've got corrupt dictators, and at the other pole you've got the religious right, mm-hmm. and you have nothing in the middle, absolutely nothing. And that's a situation that led to the revolution in Iran. That's a situation that Egypt finds itself in now. That's a situation that the Palestinians find themselves in, everywhere. And you know, with the collapse of the Cold War, then you know you don't have anything to. So it's a region that's suffering from all those traumas.
I just don't pick up a very strong feeling of compassion in this country for what everybody's going through over there. I think it's terrible. I think there's too much. I just think that.
Well, you see, but the thing is what the difficulty that it ends up getting itself in relation to asking for compassion is a situation that it has at home as well. As I say, your choice becomes between having a corrupt dictatorship and the religious right, and the religious right fighting corruption.
Right.
And everyone being essentially totally against the religious right.
That's good, alright.
Yeah. And the religious right being pretending to be the freedom fighters.
Yeah.
You know, it sends very, very mixed messages. It's a bit of a mess, you know, clearly.
What is your day to day life like in London? What part of town do you live in? Who do you hang with? And have you done theater? Have you mm-hmm. done? What's a little bit of the back of what it's like for you on a?
At the moment I live in Wimbledon in London. That's largely where I grew up. I'm a.
Wimbledon's on the west.
Southwest, yeah. I'm a full Londoner. I mean, kind of when people ask me where I'm from, the most comfortable thing I have saying really is that I'm British and I'm a Londoner. But I'm also, I say British Egyptian, but I'm a Londoner, you know, because London's my home. I totally love it. My friends come from all walks of life. I went to a school in Wimbledon called King's College. I then went off to university. I went to university at Cambridge. My kind of background in terms of acting kind of came from both those places, and the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is really where I cut my teeth. And I also lived for a year in Paris, where I studied for a year in Paris.
Where in Paris?
I lived in the 20th arrondissement.
Another one really good. Forgetting where that is.
That's east.
Oberkampf?
A bit further east of Oberkampf, exactly. Kind of around. It was my metro was Porte de Banyule. It was Rue Pelpeau.
Yeah.
So kind of near Gambetta, if you know. Near Gambetta, near. My French is pretty good. It's pretty good. I wouldn't say it's perfect, but it's I'm on the first step of fluency, I'd say. But I haven't mastered it.
What comes through in your speech, your inner quality is care, delicacy, precision. I really trust and hope that next phase that we're talking about happens. But
thank you.
I think you're a very appealing person just to speak to.
Thank you. I mean, I come.
You know,
I,
with a multicultural, yeah, all kinds of.
Absolutely. Well, that's what I am. You know, like I live in. you know, I mean, even on this film, you know, in this film we were, it's something I find so moving, you know, we were people, we came from about 26 different countries. We had on average 4 to 6 languages to translate between on set. And we're filming this film in a part of Western China that nobody knows about. And we've all come together to tell a story that's about a country that everyone kind of discovered had a huge international significance, you know? But at the same time, we are telling a story at which, as I said, the starting point is about family and about, you know, themes of friendship and betrayal and growing up and fathers and their sons. And it's about what we share, you know? And that's how I live, you know? And it's when you meet someone from another culture, you never meet them through a bomb. You never meet them through, you know, through the details of an unfound thing. You never meet them through the details of how many people died in their country today or whatever, you know? Right. You meet them through, you know, through saying hello, shaking hands, telling stories, building relationships.
Right.
And, you know, obviously we don't all live in the same country. So, you know, one of our ways of sharing that is the stories that we tell.
Sure.
And I want to be part of that in all its aspects, you know, whether it's through, you know, whether it's through culture, gender, whatever it is, but, you know.
Let me just take a couple of quick...
Sure, absolutely.
What I want to do is...
Do you want a smiley one or a normal
one? Let's try two non-smileys. What is your best angle? I want to do something other than just take a straight on shot.
Sure.
The Vermeer lighting is nice on the side of your face.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe if you angled. Yeah, that's nice. That's it. That's really nice. Okay. All right. You want to smile for this next one? That's fine. Okay. 1, 2. Got it. Okay. We're good. Thank you. You know, I had this little argument with somebody. They're shooting right now a film called Hippie Hippie Shake. You know, it's based upon the experience of the editor of Oz, the magazine.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, very much a forward. Sorry.
Sorry. I don't mind if you need to guess it, by the way. No problem.
Anyway, there's a scene with Cillian Murphy and... why am I blanking on her? You know, Factory Girl. She's a pretty.
Sienna Miller.
Yes,
right.
Miller. And they're playing, you know, the editor and his significant other, and they're marching in this large war demonstration. Ho Chi Minh. You know.
Yeah.
And I was arguing with somebody that as vast and multicultural as London is today. Quite obviously, that it was less so 30-something years ago. So, and that the strictness of people raised by Egyptian, people of Egyptian ancestry or Iranian or whoever happened to be Pakistani, that the idea of fraternizing or cross-cultural influences upon a very close-knit sense of community and family that is comes from the Middle East. But I wouldn't think that you'd see that many anti-war hippies of Middle East ancestry in the 60s. And there's a photo of like 4 women who are clearly not Anglo-Saxon British. They look to be probably from that region. And there's one guy. I said, I don't believe that. That's bad casting. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know.
You would know.
I mean, it's not quite 30 years ago. It's about 20. It's about 20. No, me.
Oh, you're.
Yeah.
Okay.
But 25 years ago, I remember being taken on demonstrations like that by my father, when he wasn't a hippie, but he was part of the. I mean, my father was put in prison a lot in Egypt during the early 70s and in the kind of post 68.
Okay.
And that's why they ended up leaving the country, because he was put in prison about 5 times and then eventually had to leave to continue his education. Atossa, who plays my wife in the film, I know that her parents grew up in Berlin.
Okay.
Both hippies. And both part of... I mean, I don't know what the breadth of it would be, but I think there's a significant... At that point, I mean, late 60s, early 70s, I'd say there was probably in Egypt... sorry, not in Egypt, in London... I mean, I can see what you're saying. I mean, in terms of there not being... you know, this one sounds like it's sort of intentionally, politically correct photo.
Mm.
But I know that there were... I mean, I know that, for example... I mean, actually, kind of in a very interesting way,
mm-hmm.
because that's the period... This is the period just before... The late 60s and 70s
mm-hmm.
is exactly the period before there was a complete crackdown on anything kind of left of centre
mm-hmm.
in the Middle East and beyond. Because before that, that was the kind of heyday.
Mm-hmm.
That was the super heyday of secularism in that whole part of the world, and which transfers as well to I would presume, to the places that they travelled. I mean, I know that goes for my parents. I mean, I've got, you know, pictures of my parents in London with flares and looking, kind of, you know, with the big hair and all that kind of thing, with all their friends and a lot of them being hippies or otherwise. And I know that at home, that's what it was, you know, like the preponderance, for example, of, and especially with the ones who would travel, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly kind of, I wouldn't extend that to the rural areas of a lot of these countries, but certainly like Kabul, for example, there was that presence in Kabul. And Kabul as well was a huge hippie destination. And also it kind of fits into the whole, you know, the whole Sufi, the Sufi presence, the kind of, I mean, there's a lot of Sufism in kind of hippie dress, if you like.
Right.
And also, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question, though.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know. Take someone like Tariq Ali, who's a British Pakistani writer. He was definitely one of those. And he started, I think, in the late 60s.
I didn't know that Tariq Ali was part or half Pakistani. What are you saying?
Yeah.
He's
either Indian or Pakistani. I'm not sure which, to be honest. But
I didn't trust his rave review of Atonement when I first came out of Venice,
right?
Because I feel that you know, the British film industry is depleted. Email.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would love to.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
How's the theater? Has there been much theater offerings? Are you interested in much in theater?
I am. I mean, it's kind of, it's funny because I mean, basically my background is theater, but I've not really done any, I've not done any big London productions.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot in Edinburgh. I did a lot at university. And then I did a couple of, I've done three professional shows in London,
mm-hmm.
but I had a year basically, which was a year when I was living solely in London,
mm-hmm.
during which time I did two shows, but also spent 6 months trying to put the theatre company that I'd had at university into a professional context. Decided that was the wrong thing to do. Went to Paris, which is where I was studying with this extraordinary teacher called Philippe Goliot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was straight after that, I was supposed to be going back to Paris, but I got United 93. So...
How did Paul encounter you? How did he help with...
I think mainly through Spotlight, which is the kind of casting directory in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were looking for actors who could speak Arabic and in London, because that's where they were going to shoot the film. And my surname starts ABD, so I guess that kind of. I went first for a casting.
Mm.
Well, the funny thing is, of course, I first heard about it. It was like, you know, it was a call saying, it's a film about 9/11, they'd like to see you for the role of a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it's like, no, thank you. Then you find out it's Paul Greengrass, you find out about how it's being done. So I went to the first audition.
Mm.
And then it was in the callback. With Paul, which was about 3 days later or something, where I met him, and then it was entirely clear the kind of film that he wanted to make.
Right.
You know, his first question was, do you think it's possible to do this film correctly? Which is an incredible first question.
Mm.
You know, totally sort of, you know, and also, you know, I said quite clearly then, was like, if it was the kind of film that I was worried that it might be, or everyone would be worried that it could be, I'm not interested, because I find it absurd, the idea of being part in something. It, you know, it's against nature to be part of something that I would feel is misrepresentative and hurts people I love, yeah. myself, whatever, when I walk down the street, you know, in terms of building false associations and all those kinds of things. And if it was that kind of film, I'm not interested. And you know, and I think that was a big part of why, in a way, I was cast, because he was looking for people who felt that way, because it was about building a team who together could work and would help each other, you know, would catch each other in the between the cracks of you know, what some people know and what other people don't know, and how they see and how they think. It's about building a team of people who we trusted.
You were in Cannes with everybody.
Yes.
I remember I was standing there with the...
What, when we did the press conference?
Yeah, the press conference.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, that was...
I've seen that film about 6 times.
That was...
Were you... I don't remember that you were at this party that they had here last December.
No. No, I wasn't. But can you do that?
Good gathering.
Yeah.
Is that Luke? It was nice, because everybody kind of knew that there were so many people in this town. They don't want to know, you know, please, I don't want to see it, it's too soon, you know. But,
Well, I was saying to someone else, like, it's,
Ben Sliney was there.
He's great,
you know?
Isn't he just one of the most wonderful people?
I just love him. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like a slow-release vitamin. United 93,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a film that a lot of people saw first off, mm-hmm. but a lot of people are seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, the number of people who I'll meet who are like, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm seeing it soon, or I know I'm going to watch it. And it's one of those ones that's kind of, mm-hmm. it's lodged, and especially with the reputation that it's built.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you.
But yeah, it's definitely not the effervescent release.
Yeah. I'm going to go see, by the way, There Will Be Blood tonight.
I really want to see that.
Paul Thomas Anderson.
I really want to see that. I am so... I'm represented by the same agent as Daniel Day-Lewis in London.
Oh, okay.
And I just think he's extraordinary. I think he's absolutely extraordinary, and I just can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
I mean, for his...
Well, why don't you call your agent and have him get...
Oh, because we've got our Academy screening this evening.
So. Oh, you're doing the Q&A and everything. Okay. Oh, this is a big night then.
Yeah, well, yeah.
How many? So this is a big membership in general.
I don't know if it's membership. I think so. I mean, it's
Okay.
I don't know how many of the Academy seats. You'd know better than me. But But yeah, tonight's a pretty big night, basically. Yeah.
Oh wow. See, it was a small group, as I said, but I saw it. You can always tell after a film is played that people are, they're warmed up, their emotional pores have been opened,
yeah.
You know, and that's unmistakable.
I have to say, it has been such a joy traveling with this film, mm-hmm. and seeing people's different reactions to it, and going to different screenings, different size screenings. One, you know, I think strangely enough, sort of two of the most moving questions or responses to the film that we've had so far. We had one just last week, earlier this week, when we screened it at UCLA, and there was an Afghan lady who stood up. And you
where
know,
was it at UCLA that mean on the campus?
It was at the Wadsworth. And there was this Afghan lady who stood up, and she was really talking to the audience as much as she was talking to us, but she felt, you know, she was standing up to say, basically, I feel represented. I feel like you've done a wonderful thing with this film, and I feel like now people will see a side to Afghanistan that they've never seen before, and say thank you. And it was beautiful to, you know, and as well that she wanted to stand up in front of everyone to say that. And then yesterday as well, we had a soldier who stood up. Yesterday we had a screening for SAG, And there was a soldier who stood up, and he'd been a soldier for 26 years, and he stood up to say, and he'd served in the, you know, in the Middle East, in that region, and he stood up to say exactly the same thing.
Where was the sound screening?
That was on the Paramount Rock.
Mm. At the big theater?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I've never watched a film in there. I've only watched one in the smaller one.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of great screening places in LA.
Something about
you feel kind of spoiled. You go back to London and you're like, the quality of the cinemas here just doesn't compare.
It really does matter.
Oh God.
I mean, it's you know, people underestimate it, but it's like movies are like theater. That if you see it with a really responsive,
absolutely
open crowd, it somehow feels like a better film.
Absolutely. No. It's been amazing because I've seen it in different situations, different sound setups, different size screens. And sometimes you feel like it's a bit too quiet, or the acoustic doesn't suit it. It's exactly like a touring play, you know. Like you go in some place and the acoustic doesn't suit it, or
right.
The stage dwarfs the, or the auditorium dwarfs, you know, whatever it might be.
Mm.
And this one definitely plays best with the sound turned up just a little bit.